Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable discusses how can we best defend America? Taking part in this program are Robert A. Taft, United States Senator from Ohio, Hanson Baldwin, military analyst of the New York Times, and Malcolm Sharp of the Law School of the University of Chicago. And now to begin today's roundtable on how can we best defend America, Mr. Sharp.
What are the military facts of the present Russian threat? What foreign policy best takes account of these military facts? How great is the danger that Russia will attack us? What more can we do now to defend America? Senator Taft, let's begin by hearing your view on whether we should build up land forces or count on sea and air power to defend America.
Well, Mr. Sharp, I think we have to have all three, but we have to understand this basic limitation. Even a country like the United States can't do everything that could possibly be done to build up against a war with Russia in time of peace. I suppose the military people could give us projects that would cost $150 billion a year, half of our entire production, such as we did in all-out war in the Second World War. But it would destroy liberty in this country. It would completely wreck the civilian economy of the country. It would build up the public debt. It couldn't be paid for. And we have to remember that this is a condition that may go on for 10 years. This is something we've never seen before. And so among these various projects, we have to be selective. When we select, I think the most important thing is the development of an air power, combined, of course, with control of the seas by the Navy, which will dominate the air over this country, as far as possible over the oceans surrounding this country, and as far as possible present an aggressive attack against Russia itself. That seems to me the first requirement. There are many other things we can do, which no doubt will be developed on land and on sea.
Baldwin, you are a graduate of the Naval Academy and an experienced military analyst. Do we depend on sea and air power or on land power for our defense?
Well, we depend on all three, Mr. Sharp. A great lesson, it seems to me, of Korea, and for that matter of World War II, is the indivisibility of military force. I would agree with Senator Taft completely that priority must go to sea power and air power, because only by sea or by air can attack come to the United States, which must be the secure base of all our military operations. And only by sea and by air can we take aid to any enemy, or for that matter, fight any war against any power overseas. But I think Senator Taft overlooked the fact that unless we have land power and land power overseas, we can't control the seas and the air over the North Atlantic and the Pacific. Land power, as Korea showed, is still essential.
Well, but it's essential if we go on to the landmass of Asia or Europe, but we never should have been in Korea, Mr. Baldwin. That's the answer to that requirement. I don't say that we shouldn't have land power, of course, or assist in Europe. I just voted for the contribution to a European army, but certainly it seems to me that it is capable of such indefinite increase in use of men and expense that in time of peace we can't positively rely on land operations on the continent of Europe or Asia, which are so extremely expensive and difficult.
We doubtless all agree that foreign policy is our first defense. We hope that foreign policy will keep us out of war. And yet foreign policy and military policy are now always closely intertwined. I suppose one thing we need to have is some sense of what the next war would be like if we have to have one. What do you think of that, Mr. Baldwin?
Well, it seems to me, Mr. Sharp, that we sometimes tend to put the cart before the horse in some of this. I think we've got to know first what kind of a world we want, and then and only then can we formulate the strategy we would use to fight any war we might have to fight to win that world. In other words, more simply, we've got to have a clear idea of our political objectives in the world. If we allow military strategy first to dominate the picture, then the military dominate foreign policy, and not only that, we will lose the peace a second time.
Do you think we really asked the wrong question first?
I do.
Well, I think I only have this reservation. I agree with Mr. Baldwin. I have this reservation that I doubt if anybody is enough of a prophet today to say what the Third World War is going to look like. And one of my objections to the Atlantic Pact and to the European army business has been that it seemed to me to commit us to a particular kind of war when maybe that wouldn't be the kind of war we'd like to fight when we come to that war. I quite agree, though, that we ought, as far as possible, decide what that war is going to look like and then prepare for the particular thing we think is coming.
My great point, Senator, is if we try to fight an unlimited war again, a war for unlimited objectives, unconditional surrender or whatnot, if we are going into the war with the idea of completely demolishing Russia and destroying her as Carthage was destroyed, or dropping a lot of A-bombs indiscriminately, then we will lose the peace. I think we can fight a limited war against Russia and can deliberately plan to do so.
Well, I agree with this, that certainly the unconditional surrender policy, the theory of wiping Russia out, is antagonistic to every thought I have. How far you can limit your war once you start it, I certainly would, I don't know. I think that's somewhat doubtful.
Well, Marvin, what objectives would you set to control us?
It's been done in the past. Limited wars against Russia have been fought successfully in the past. The Russo-Japanese War, the Crimean War, even Charles of Sweden before he got the bug and tried to march deep into Russia. Now, if we ever try to march to Moscow type of strategy, unlimited war either by land or an unlimited atomic war, I think we could conceivably lick ourselves or lose the peace. But land power in defense of Western Europe, coupled with selective atomic bombing, particularly of Russian oil refineries and communications, and the use of combined land, sea, and air power for peripheral action against certain areas in Russia, such as the Arctic, the Black Sea, Sakhalin, upon which Russia depends for oil supply in the Far East. These things, limited operations of this sort, far from the Russian centers of power, could, I think, defeat Russia.
Well, you think, in other words, you could destroy their productive ability to maintain an army in the field by selective bombing of those sources of supply of oil and important munitions of all kinds.
Coupled with the use of land and sea power, to force them to fight at places which we choose, not places that they choose. In other words, the Crimean Peninsula, for instance. That's why the British were able to win that war with their allies, because only a limited part of Russia's vast land power could possibly be employed there. The same thing would be true of Sakhalin.
So that you would not commit a vast land army to a project of trying to actually occupy Russia.
Oh, I would never attempt to occupy all of Russia. It would seem to me that might be fatal.
Well, that strikes a sympathetic note with me. Providing that you, by these other means, it turned out that you could actually destroy the whole power of Russia in the field. But you do feel, don't you, Mr. Baldwin, that today that Russia could overrun Europe if they started out to do so?
Yes, I do, Senator. I think that is, of course, the basic problem we face now, how to prevent that.
Well, now, you aim at a much less drastic solution than most people are discussing nowadays. You don't think of a march to Moscow. You don't think of the devastating kind of bombing that some people imagine. You think of this bombing around the edges, these attacks around the edges. What purpose would you have in view? You spoke of objectives.
Don't mistake me, Mr. Sharp. I don't mean bombing around the edges. I said the use of land power to seize air bases around the edges. The bombing would go to the heart of the Russian oil refineries, for instance, wherever they might be located, and would devastate the Russian communication system. But I certainly am not in favor of the indiscriminate bombing of cities.
Well, if you had an airport in Turkey, we'll say, defended by American troops, what's to prevent the Russians from wiping that airport out if they've got an airport not so far away that undertakes to destroy that airport?
It's quite conceivable they could do it, Senator Taft. It all depends, it seems to me, upon the relative power of our air forces and of our ground troops. They might conceivably overrun Turkey and seize the airport by physical means. But that comes back again to the use of land power and the use of all military force, which I think is indivisible.
Well, I think it's indivisible, too, but it seems to me that that what you assume is you can win a war against Russia if we finally secure complete control of the air. After all, we won the war against Germany and Japan after we had achieved complete control of the air. Japan was licked before we sent a soldier to Japan. I think it's possible we may win a war from the air alone, but that requires an all-powerful air force, and we can't afford to neglect it by setting up armies all over the world.
Would you encourage revolutions within Russia? Do you think there's some hope there?
Yes, I omitted that in my prescription, which is, of course, a vague one of how to lick Russia. I certainly think that Russian weaknesses, internal weaknesses, must be exploited. The Ukrainian minorities, the Cossacks, of course, the people behind the Iron Curtain satellite countries, many of them, given proper support, use of the dropping of arms from the air, the dropping of leaders, the dropping of literature, would be allies of ours in case of war.
But don't you think even in time of peace, before that war starts, we could set up a quiet organization with many of these refugees from these countries who would go back and make real trouble for Russia within the various nations that are now where probably a very small proportion of the people really favor communism?
Well, I imagine that some small amount of that may be going on, but I don't believe that that could be decisive in peacetime unless there was outside pressure also exerted against Russia.
Well, I talked to Bill Donovan the other day, who ran the OSS in the war, and he says there just is no intelligent operating head here for that kind of warfare against Russia today, and that there ought to be. And it seems to me that I fully agree. I think the whole question of propaganda, the voice of America is all right as far as it goes, but I do think that we can do a much more intelligent publicity stunt in these countries. And then there is this infiltration technique that the Russians use so well themselves. If they can even succeed in a country like the United States, presumably we have a much better chance of succeeding in a country where probably four-fifths of the people want liberty and are opposed to communism.
The ultimate purpose of this type of warfare would not be to introduce democracy into Russia, or would it?
I should think that if we started to determine the exact type of government that was going to succeed the communist government in Russia, that we would be starting to fight an almost unlimited war. I should think our first purpose ought to be, politically, to destroy Russia's offensive capacity. And secondly, I would say free the Iron Curtain countries, Eastern Europe, from Russian domination. I would not, and I agree fully with Senator Taft in this, ever attempt an all-out occupation of Russia. I think if we accomplish those first two objectives, just one final point, if we accomplish those first two objectives, I think it would probably automatically mean the overthrow of the present communist government in Moscow.
Yes, I don't think we can set out on this ideological basis of telling people what kind of a government they have to have. That's not our purpose. Our purpose is to reduce them to a point where they're no longer a threat to the peace and security of the world and of the United States. And if the Russian people then themselves don't see fit to change their form of government, well, that's their concern, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, may I make one other important point, Mr. Sharp, which I admitted in this idea of what kind of a war we should fight? And that is that my first premise is that we must defend Western Europe. That unless Western Europe is defended, if Western Europe, for instance, should be overrun within the immediate future, we would lose all the things we're trying to defend there, because regardless of whether we liberated it or not, whether we bombed Russia intensively or not, I believe that when the peace came, there would be a triumph of extreme political views of either the right or the left. Western Europe couldn't afford to be a battlefield again, be overrun, dominated by Russia, without going right or left. And we have to defend Western Europe.
Well, I'd like to defend Western Europe. The question is, how big an army is necessary for that purpose? Where is it coming from? How big an army do you think you ought to have to defend Western Europe, Mr. Baldwin?
Well, I think that depends entirely upon how large an enemy army Russia has, and I think we tend to overemphasize...
They say 175 to 200 divisions, which are smaller, of course.
Yes. I think we tend to overemphasize what Russia can do. We talk about her overrunning Western Europe, the Middle East, Turkey, Greece, the North Africa.
Yes, but they have a choice of doing one or the other. And supposing they choose Western Europe, then how big an army must you have to defend Western
Europe?
Well,
I think probably the one in which General Eisenhower is engaged, from 45 to 60 divisions, eventually. We haven't got it now. And the problem is now.
Don't you think the European nations will have to put up most of that?
I do.
And if the... another thing that's curious to me is where we're going to defend Western Europe. Where is that point we're going to defend Western Europe?
The line, you mean?
More or less. I know, General.
The Rhine or the Elbe. Or,
Well,
I think that again depends on the number of divisions. The type of defense that is feasible today might be nothing but the defense of the Brittany Peninsula by the divisions that are there now. But
all you ought to maintain is a toehold in Europe. Why don't you maintain it in Turkey?
It's
a lot easier than trying to maintain Brittany.
Well, up to now, your picture of the war has been a lot less disturbing than most of the pictures we get. But we're getting into the question now as to whether it's really a likely possibility. Whether this thing can happen.
Whether we can fight a limited war?
Yeah.
That's in the laps of the dark, it seems to me. It would take strong men with high purpose and with a very great sense of the future political objectives of the country and the world, to hold our strategy to such a limited war, given the provocations of actual war.
Well, I say, I'm willing to try it, but I don't really think you're going to get that question decided, Mr. Sharp, until the war actually starts, and I hope it may never start. What we have now is mainly the question of deterring Russia. There, I think the sea and air is the biggest deterrent. I have no objection to an army in Western Europe, but I think that if that's going to be a successful army, it must be with the enthusiastic support of the people who are defending themselves. They have more people than we have. I have no objection contributing our share, but I want it understood, because I think it's an essential condition of success, that they do put up a great majority of that army. And that's the only reason that I think we should not make that a major American project, a European land army.